This is How to Stop Climate Change. I'm David Butler, and this is my daughter, Keaton.
Our guest today is Samantha Richardson, founder and CEO of Ethical Profit Accounting Agency. Her experiences working with small businesses around the world and passion for the environment have culminated in her last book, Ethical Profit, A Guide to Increasing Profit Using Sustainable Business Practices. It's designed to help empower SMEs to work together towards a new sustainable economy.
So you're an accountant and you have your own accounting firm and you've written a book called Ethical Profit, which is about sustainability for business. And in my day job, I lead our sustainability team. And when I think of champions in the company that are helping to drive sustainability, the accounting department is not the first department that comes to mind.
Yes. Unfortunately, accountants have kind of been the opposite of champions for the environment and sustainability movement. But I think that they are really key roles in sustainability and the climate change movement, because business is a huge sector that is often blamed for the problems of climate emergency, and rightly so, but they are never brought in to the conversation with language that they understand. And a lot of businesses only really understand the language of finance. They speak a lot to the CFOs and the finance, and they're not necessarily able to translate the finance to sustainability in a way that's really meaningful for them, because they have to measure everything very quantitatively. And so the thing that accountants can do is really use their understanding of numbers and data and apply that to sustainability metrics, and translating kind of why sustainability is important within the supply chain or within any other aspect of pieces in your business. You are able to then bring that again to the table in a way that they can understand. And unfortunately, we've kind of used that to the opposite effect for a lot of years, saying that like that there's exploitative value essentially in labor and with resources. But now that's kind of turning, and we're seeing people really wanting to put things like carbon taxes in to put value on the pollution, or to put value on the stresses that businesses have on the earth. And so I think accountants are really key roles in this, and it's imperative that we kind of bring those folks into the fold and kind of help them see why it's important.
And when you're talking about carbon taxes, you know, there's all sorts of talk about whether we need to have those externally coming from governments. Mm-hmm. And of course, we have some in the world. Mm-hmm. But some companies are even kind of putting their own price on carbon and having an internal carbon tax, aren't they?
Yes. And I think that's actually really smart of those businesses, because the businesses who already see the writing on the wall, whether or not it happens this year, next year, in 5 years, there will be some kind of carbon tax, whatever that looks like. It looks different in different places and different companies, but getting ahead of that curve is really important for long-term sustainability of their business. So they're seeing that, okay, this is going to be a thing that we have to deal with in the future. We're going to figure out all the problems of this now, so that when governments come in and say, you need to do this by X date, we're already ahead of the curve. And that ahead of the curve kind of narrative is extremely important in business. You only get innovation and some kind of competitive edge if you're ahead of the curve, if you're seeing the government regulation come down the pipeline and go, okay, well, we're going to get ahead of this. We're going to put this somehow into our business now. We're going to figure out all the issues, because doing this kind of stuff isn't super intuitive. It's not going to be okay, turn the lights on and we have a carbon tax and everything is peachy. There's a lot to be figured out. And so that's a really smart way for them to not just get ahead of this regulation, but also build things like brand equity and customer loyalty, because customers who see that effort really appreciate it, because I think it's like 70% of millennials would choose to buy from a company that is more sustainable or have these kinds of initiatives in place than a competitor that is similarly priced. And so you've got the not just competitive advantage from a customer point of view, but also then from the innovation side of things.
Yeah, I guess part of the value of having an internal carbon price and a sustainability program in general is to make the company more efficient. So you reduce waste, right?
Exactly. Because those carbon prices will show you where the biggest inefficiencies are.
Can you take the money that you're charging yourself in your internal carbon tax and invest it in ways in the company that will help drive efficiency?
Sometimes they do. It depends on the company. Some folks do this by giving money to an external company that is working on implementing sustainable initiatives like clean energy or building water filtration and more efficient stoves for developing nations so they can kind of skip the entire carbon phase of life. So that there's ways you can do it externally, but internally you can do this by then, yes, as you said, putting the money into a kind of a sustainability bank account that you then spend on bigger initiatives that will, again, make your company more efficient. So as you save that money, you invest it in ways that make your company more efficient or more sustainable that you can then invest again in bigger initiatives. So like you might not be able to buy, for example, solar panels for your entire business right away, but you can start small and build up to it over many years.
So when I think of accounting, I think of, you know, people that are focused on making sure the company is profitable and that everything balances and you're paying all the bills and you're taking care of your shareholders or your owners. And so I guess in the past, maybe it has seemed like spending money on sustainability was kind of an extra expense that was going to cut down those profits. But if you're looking far out into the future, the question of profitability changes a lot, right?
Absolutely. And I think this is an inherent flaw in modern business methodology, shall we say, because I always learned growing up, like any business, well, in Australia, anywhere where I'm from, we have a very strong principle around businesses are going to exist forever. And so you need to presume that you're planning for the long term. That might not be the case. Like the reality obviously is very different, but your philosophy is to plan for long term. And that doesn't always work in modern business because a lot of business decisions are done on short-term profit basis, which I think is extremely toxic as a mentality in general, because you have business leaders who are making choices that are on how to make the biggest profit in the shortest term, which tends to be very detrimental to the company long-term. And you can look at any number of case studies around this. So thinking about Ford Pinto is quite a big business scandal where they made a very short-term detrimental decision to allow cars that they knew were faulty to continue to be sold and used by consumers because they had done a cost-benefit analysis and it was more beneficial to the company to allow people to die and pay the insurance than to recall the cars and fix the problem.
The Ford Pinto was a subcompact car, which became infamous in the 1970s for bursting into flames if its gas tank was ruptured in a rear-end collision. In 1972, Lily Gray and her passenger Richard Grimshaw were traveling in her Pinto on a California freeway when it stalled. They were rear-ended by another car that was traveling about 30 miles an hour. The Pinto's gas tank ruptured, releasing gasoline vapors that quickly spread to the passenger compartment. A spark ignited the mixture, and the Pinto exploded into a ball of fire. Mrs. Gray died, but her passenger Richard Grimshaw survived. He had horrible burns that required numerous surgeries. The resulting lawsuit, Grimshaw versus Ford Motor Company, uncovered how Ford rushed the Pinto through production and onto the market in spite of known safety issues related to the gas tank. A Ford memo that compared the cost of addressing gas tank safety issues with the costs of damages related to injuries and deaths caused by those safety issues was also uncovered. According to the memo, those safety issues could have been addressed for $11 per car. The jury awarded $127.8 million in damages, the largest ever in a U.S. product liability case at that time. Ford was able to get the damages reduced to less than $7 million. In another high-profile case, they were charged with reckless homicide. In 1978, three teenage girls were killed when their Pinto was rear-ended. In that case, Indiana versus Ford Motor Company, Ford was charged with reckless homicide, the first time a corporation faced criminal charges for a defective product, and the first time a corporation was charged with homicide. There were approximately 117 lawsuits brought against Ford over rear-end Pinto accidents. Ford eventually recalled 1.5 million Ford Pintos and Mercury Bobcats, the largest recall in automotive history at that time. So they ended up having to fix the gas tanks anyway, but only after several people died needlessly.
This is obviously very wrong. for a number of reasons. And when they were found out, they were fined huge amounts of money that they then lost because of this very callous short-term decision that is now used across the board for a lot of companies when they do recalls. It's like, this is why we do this, because if we do not do this, the fines will be in excess of whatever amount we can imagine would be beneficial to allow these products to be on the shelves. And I remember when I heard about this, it was like, oh, companies are not going to do the right thing unless there's a profit motive behind it.
You know, you could make the argument that that is one of the most premeditated kinds of murder.
Yep.
Wow, that's a really horrible story.
It is. It gives me chills just thinking about it, because how can you as a person decide it's okay that people over there are going to die so that I can be paid tonight? Like, it's just awful. But these things happen all the time in business, because they're like, oh, I don't care that the Amazon is burning. I want my insert product from Amazon farmers here.
Samantha has a new book out on the relationship between business and the environment.
So my book, Ethical Profit, A Guide to Increasing Profit Using Sustainable Business Practices, is really aimed to small businesses so that they're able to understand and use some resources that aren't really available to them. Because when we have conversations about sustainability, a lot of that is geared toward really large companies. But most of the carbon and most of the pollution is actually generated by SMEs as a collective. So the individual company doesn't add a whole lot to the carbon emissions in any particular country, but as a whole, they are more than 50% of that country's emissions. And that's because they're not necessarily able to really see that they're making any kind of difference. Whereas if every single company in the entire country were able to just move that needle a little bit, it would have huge implications. And a lot of things that are around sustainability are actually really beneficial to small businesses in the short term as well. Because generally speaking, if you're a business owner, I'm not sure if you have this experience or run into people that know this, but I myself as a business owner find myself wearing many hats, and I'm always running around like a chicken with its head cut off, mostly trying to just keep the business afloat and manage all of the various aspects of a business. And so when you want to then add sustainability on top of that, it feels very much like, oh my God, just one more thing to do. But if you frame your entire business through a lens of sustainability, it's actually really beneficial and has kind of knock-on effects along the way. And I mentioned in the book a few different things around reducing waste is a really key element of this. So one of the smaller or more immediate things that companies can do is do things like a waste or an energy audit, which doesn't have to be super big or involved. It just is about noticing. That's all audits really are. Accountants will go in and ask questions when you have a financial audit, just to make sure that things are being done in the best way possible. And you only find that out if you ask questions. It's about encouraging that kind of thing, encouraging a look at, okay, are you actually valuing your company appropriately? Because if you don't have financial sustainability, your company's not going to stick around. So you need to make sure you're valuing your products appropriately, but also then therefore your raw materials. Because if you want to be for example, premium brand, if you're buying the cheapest material, are you really a premium brand? So those kind of things that need to be considered. And so then I also have a bit more in-depth things that people can do, where it's looking at things like collaborating with the supply chain. And when you do this, generally speaking, will benefit not just yourself, but your customers and your suppliers. And everyone really loves this. When you're able to collaborate with people who provide you with goods to make it more efficient to get them to you, or to make them in a more efficient way, or make them in a way that will reduce waste along the entire stream of the product line. So you might not in your business necessarily make a lot of waste, but getting that product to you might be very wasteful. Are there ways that things can change that will make that a much more efficient and less wasteful process? And then I also have a third larger section where you have bigger actions that you can take in your business. And these are things like looking at the B Corp certification, which is a kind of certification that is similar to Fair Trade for coffee. B Corp is for business. And this is very involved, but if you're really committed to being more sustainable, you can look at this because they have a lot of really good ideas that you can sink your teeth into and can adjust for your business, or do things like change your bank. I strongly recommend everybody open up a credit union account and move their business money into it, or start using it and kind of slowly move your money there, because money is the language of business. And credit unions are really key pillars of local business, and we really want to focus on helping those small businesses. And we're learning kind of why it's so critical to support local businesses, because they employ millions and millions of people around the country. So helping them in any way that is possible, and you can do that with your money. It doesn't actually cost you anything to put your money into a bank that's focused on your local community. It does, however, have quite a high like psychological barrier, which is what that third section is about, that the psychological barrier is larger. So you have to kind of build yourself up to it.
I know you mentioned, of course, as an accountant, you're a numbers person, and there's kind of a power in looking at the numbers. And I don't know that all CEOs or entrepreneurs think that way. You know, probably some of them are very analytical, but as you mentioned, some of them are just wearing a lot of hats and they're full of confidence and they have a vision for what they want to do. So they can't be bothered with looking at the numbers on certain things. But you have a section in the book where you're talking about life cycle cost as opposed to just looking at the immediate cost when you're purchasing equipment or something. And you had one example of just a decision about what kind of light bulbs to buy.
Yeah.
Tell us what life cycle cost is, first of all.
Sure. So life cycle cost is looking at the cost of something from the mining of the raw materials to the production of the input. So if that's like a light bulb, the wires and the glass that go into the light bulb, and then the usage of it and how that much it costs to use it, and then the disposal. And generally speaking, almost everything that we make doesn't actually account for any of those costs appropriately, either because we're not paying for the raw materials properly, so they're not being valued at what they really are. Because if you think about it, like a light bulb has to have the raw materials mined, the glass has to be created, it has to be shipped across the world. These things tend to be manufactured overseas, so those materials are mined in one part of the world, they're shipped to another part of the world, assembled, shipped back across the world, used, and then they're disposed of somehow. And that's not a cheap process, generally speaking. We're able to have cheaper unit costs because we'll do this in massive batches. But the most expensive or most problematic part of any product's life cycle is at the end, because we tend to be very bad at recycling or very inefficient with it. We're not necessarily really looking at what it costs us as a society to have massive landfills full of junk, essentially. And so you really want to look at how do you reduce the things going to landfill, because it very soon will become a very big problem. And it's going to cost a lot of money to solve that problem. Whereas if we just avoid the problem entirely, we're able to save a lot. Then bringing that cost into the life cycle cost, thinking, okay, how do I reduce its impact on the land and make it kind of appropriately cost for its entire usage? LED lights, for example, would then be much more attractive because the other types of light bulbs would be more appropriately costed for the waste that they create, because the life cycle is a lot less and you get a lot less use out of them.
We'll be right back after this short break.
Do you have a great idea for stopping climate change? We want to hear it. There aren't any silver bullets for fighting climate change. There isn't any one technology that's going to pull all of the excess carbon out of the atmosphere. A lot of people say we need to quit arguing about silver bullets and focus on silver buckshot, a lot of partial solutions. Actually, we probably need a whole silver artillery barrage. Anyway, you get the point. It doesn't have to be the only idea or the best idea, just something you think someone should be doing. If you'd like to share an idea, please go to howtostopclimatechange.com and record a quick voice message about it. We'll pick an idea to share and discuss it in each episode. So tell me a little bit about B Corps. I've always been interested in those, but I'm not completely clear on what the difference is between a traditional corporation and a B corporation. And I don't think they're available everywhere.
Sure. B Corps are amazing. Bless them. They have a very rigorous certification process that they need to go through that is looking at kind of how they measure up to best practices. It's very comprehensive, this assessment that they have, looking at your labor practices to how you include maternity or sick leave into your policies around your workforce, and then looking at your financial transparency, and then things like your supplies, depending on how this relates to your business. Like, some people have much more weight given to their suppliers because they are in a manufacturing industry, for example. So it's really important that they are working with suppliers who are sustainable. And how do they actually prove that they are sustainable? How do they check these things?
To give a little more background, in 2007, a nonprofit organization called B-Lab, the B stands for benefit, was formed to, in their words, accelerate a global culture shift to redefine success in business and build a more inclusive and sustainable economy. As Samantha just mentioned, one of the ways they have done this is by creating a rigorous certification process for companies to basically prove that they are doing things ethically and sustainably. For a company to call themselves a certified B Corporation, they must meet the highest standards of verified social and environmental performance, public transparency, and legal accountability to balance profit and purpose.
It was actually created because the American law around business, so their business legal definitions, require a business to prioritize profit and shareholder value above all else, which, as we talked about, is very bad for business long term. And so the B Corporation was created in the USA as a way to kind of circumvent that, because they didn't want to be legally beholden to profit when they, you know, a lot of business owners know that it's better to be prioritizing other stakeholders, like your suppliers, like your customers, because that's where long-term sustainability comes from. The movement started in the US and it kind of expanded out to as many countries. And I believe most places you can become B Corp. It's not necessarily super easy to do this in every country. So there are companies all over the world that are B Corped, and in every place where there is a B Corp or any kind of movement, they have a really beautiful kind of community connection and wanting to work together to make business better for many people and help other people become B Corps if they're so inclined. And so I really think that it's a really great movement, and I really hope that it becomes more mainstream, because I think that every business should be a B Corp. And if you can't like fit into this kind of standards, you shouldn't really be a business, because we as business owners have to work for the greater good of society, because we will not survive if we do not give back to society. And that's kind of the philosophy of a B Corp.
So the idea that profit is the only thing that matters, you know, you mentioned that that's very short-sighted. Mm-hmm. Most kind of big general rules like that I find are short-sighted, because there's no, you know, there's no one silver bullet thing. You have to look at the balance of different things. So I wondered, have you looked at profitability for B Corps? Are they better investments, or do they underperform against other more profit motivated companies?
That is a great question. I'm so glad you asked that. So I did actually ask, I interviewed a number of B Corps for my book, and I had also sent out a survey to ask them how their profit or their revenues were post B Corp. And they, a lot of them, it depends, obviously, on your industry, on your company. But a lot of them have either saved money, which is a very difficult thing to measure. But if you consider employees, a lot of millennials, I think the statistic is something like 70% of millennials prefer to work for a sustainable company. And most businesses' greatest cost is their payroll, is their workforce. So they might not necessarily make more revenue, but they save on the expenses side when it comes to things like their employees, because they're not losing people every year. People are staying on longer. People, millennials, are even willing to have a slight pay cut to work for a sustainable company. Not that I recommend doing that, but you're able to keep people, and that's the more important thing, is you're able to keep people when trying to, you know, have bright minds stay in a company is almost impossible these days. So having a B corporation, like millennials are really, really excited by this. There's a number of tech companies in Toronto that I interviewed and that I've talked to that have managed to quantify this, these amounts, because they're able to increase their revenue slightly with their sustainability, with their B Corp certification, but they save so much money, because if you look at the rest of the industry, they're having, you know, people walk out left, right, and center, but they haven't lost a single person unless it was to go on like maternity leave or to move to a different country because their spouse had gotten a different job. So they have saved a lot of money on hiring and training because they've kept the same people. And so these are things that are just looking at the finances in a slightly different way to realize the savings that you have made on investing in your company and in your workforce.
I bet there's an additional effect too, which is probably even harder to measure. But, you know, certainly in a company where employee morale is low, even the people that stay, if they're not engaged, they kind of do the minimum amount of work and they don't put any of their own creativity into things. But if they're engaged and they believe in what they're doing, then they, you know, their productivity is so much higher.
Absolutely. And that is harder to measure. I know that, I'm sure people have done it, but they also talk about this where it's like you are helping your people feel wanted and feel valued. And that has such enormous impacts on your company in ways you don't necessarily realize right away. You have to wait to see how that unfolds, and that those benefits don't usually show up until 5-10 years later, but there will always be rewards for doing right by people.
Yeah. Are there some brands that most people would recognize that are B Corps?
Patagonia is a really big one people might know. The Body Shop has been the most recent big name B Corp. Ben & Jerry's is another one.
Here's some other B Corps you may have heard of. Allbirds, Stonyfield Organic, Cabot Creamery, Hootsuite, New Belgium Brewing, Natura, and Tom's.
Tell us about your background and how you grew up and what inspired you to focus on making companies more sustainable.
So I actually grew up on a farm. My father and my grandfather were accountants, but they were like hobbyist farmers. And so when you grow up on a farm, you get to really understand the link between climate and business. And that circular economy, the circular costing that I was referring to, because if it doesn't rain, your crops don't grow, and you don't have money because you can't sell any product. And so growing up in this kind of environment, you get to see every year, Australia goes through a period of drought pretty sickly. Like we have 3 years of flooding, 3 years of normal weather, 3 years of drought, rinse, repeat, that cycle goes on forever. And so during the drought years, if you expect that, you're able to manage that risk. And so you use a lot of business language to kind of look at these farmers and go, okay, well, they're basically managing the weather. But when you have climate change, they can no longer do this. And I was able to really apply these principles when I went to university, and I see how companies are just one step more removed from a farming life. But so many businesses are completely dependent upon agriculture or raw materials. So if you're looking at, for example, wanting to make chocolate, you need to have cocoa. And unless those farmers are able to grow it, then you can't have your chocolate business. And so understanding how weather and climate change really is going to impact every single business from the farmers and then downstream. And if we can't grow food in the way that we have because the weather changes, what are we going to do? Like, what businesses are going to survive in a post-climate change world unless we really work on mitigating climate change? It is a risk that every single business should have at their, like, the top of their list under pandemics now. So pandemic is biggest risk. Second biggest risk needs to be climate change, because the effects are just as far reaching and just as devastating, because it will touch every single business. Because if you can't get your raw materials from a supplier because they had a bad year, because there was a rare flood, because they've had many years of drought, or vice versa, then you going to struggle in your business, and helping to implement sustainable practices in your supply chain will help you to then weather those risks and that disruption a little bit easier. There's many studies that have looked at kind of what crops are going to be affected. And I read a recent article that said that wine will be a more of a luxury in the future because the wine grapes are very, very sensitive to weather changes. But that's one thing. But every single crop is affected by weather. And a few degrees warming will cause havoc amongst the agricultural industry. And I think people who want to say that the climate emergency is just this kind of made up, or it's not as dramatic as anyone is talking about, has never tried to grow food for other people. Like, I watched my friends and my father's friends try to deal with years of drought. It is devastating to watch them try to, you know, battle with completely external things and things they have absolutely no control over. And it is super frustrating to listen to people say, like, oh, it's not that big of a deal. You can tell that to somebody who's starving and they'll be like, well, there's nothing. We have nothing without food. We have no motivation. You have no future because you can't feed people. And it's absolutely critical that the agricultural industry is able to weather climate change, or indeed, if we are able to mitigate climate change so there is no impact on the agricultural sector. So, because it's the start of everything. Every other business is impacted by agriculture to some degree.
One thing that you left out of your background story is that I noticed that you started a Quidditch club when you were in college.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, so I'm a huge nerd. I love Harry Potter. I think it's a great story and something that's kind of really run away with people, which I love, because I was in America on a student exchange program, and there was a Quidditch club at the local university in America that I joined and had such a great time with. It's definitely more exercise than I normally get because I'm not a sporty type person. I like soccer, but I don't enjoy running around kicking a ball.
I'm sure flying is really difficult.
Yeah. So they, they have their standardized brooms that you run with, but it's really cleverly designed. So it is a sport designed after the Harry Potter Quidditch, but obviously instead of flying, you run with, but you have brooms between your legs. So it's kind of like a candy cap where you have to hold it. So you're only playing with one hand unless you're the keeper. So you're in front of people, or in front of hoops, sorry. And when I went back to Australia, I was like, I have to start this. This is just so much fun because you get to find people who are also really nerdy and also really love a thing that you love, which is Harry Potter, but get some exercise and some fun in there. And I really enjoyed it. I had such an overwhelming response. I was so not ready for how many people wanted to join or were interested. It was a little bit less organized than in America because our access to brooms are, we only really have like the normal brooms, whereas in the US you have like these little Halloween broom. Halloween's not a thing in Australia.
So, oh, that's sad.
Yeah. So we had a little bit of trouble trying to find like appropriately sized broomsticks, but it was it was really fun. It was definitely the highlight of my university years.
Well, so there's a business niche for somebody in Australia that wants to make Quidditch brooms.
Oh, absolutely.
Sustainably.
Yes.
What advice would you give to people that are feeling frustrated about climate change and they want to do something about it in their career or maybe just at home?
So I always encourage people to do what they can because every little bit helps. The analogy I give is that if you're going to Starbucks or Tim Hortons every day, if you're going 300 times a year, but getting the cup, you are contributing to a waste stream that is 90 billion cups, because if there are 300 million people in a Starbucks every day, it's 90 million billion cups that are being thrown into landfill because you cannot recycle the cups that are given to you at a coffee shop. So even though it seems like it's not actually helping, there are more than 300 million people in the US. There are 33 million people in Canada. If we all do one thing that helps, that is 33 million people that are doing something. And that something isn't always going to be the same, but you can do something that is either reducing waste, that's reducing energy, that is is supporting a sustainable business, whatever you're able to do is enough. Remember that you are helping, even though it seems insignificant, because it's moving the needle. And every time we move the needle, we're making gains. If you want to do bigger things, you can always look at moving money, because money is massively powerful. If your retirement funds are in fossil fuels or in funds that are not very sustainable, I would recommend looking at selling them and investing in companies that are more sustainable. Online, there's a number of various websites that are dedicated to telling you what index funds and sustainable stock market options are available. And then taking your money out of a bank and putting it into a credit union. Again, money is extremely powerful. And if that money isn't being invested in questionable ways in a bigger bank, and they're obviously always investing in fossil fuels, they're always investing in whoever comes in the door. And it's not necessarily that they're going to be exclusively looking at sustainable options. So you can put that money in a credit union where they're going to, at the very least, fund and support your local businesses, which are really important to keeping your community healthy. So those are two things you can look at and do. And they're not that hard. It's just a very big mental block, usually, looking at your finances, because a lot of people are very much like, oh no, I don't want to look at this. But you can make so much more of a difference if you are investing your money sustainably and putting your money in a credit union.
That's something that's very easy to procrastinate about. I've been procrastinating about that, and I've also been procrastinating about my taxes. So maybe I need to take your advice and do both of those things.
Absolutely. And like, I was one of these people too. Like, I now have my retirement fund is sustainable, but it took me 4 years to do that. And every year it would come around to tax time. Usually I would be like, oh, I really need to move this money, but it seems so hard. And it was literally just go onto the website, find my tax number, submit, essentially. Like, it was a bit harder than that, but it's not that hard. A lot of these things, it's not that difficult. It just is not allowing yourself to procrastinate for yet another year.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode of How to Stop Climate Change, please give us a review or share the show with a friend. If you'd like to support the show, please head over to howtostopclimatechange.com/support. All donations will go to cover expenses and help me pay my daughter, Keaton, for all the time she spends editing and producing the show. I couldn't do this without her.
Music for this episode was done by Grace Vanthoff, Avery Reedy, and myself, Keaton Butler. Our theme music is by Juices.